Coming up next on Louisiana Eats, we're tracing the path from cradle to culinary greatness. Chef John Currents reflects on the formative moments that led him to become a James Beard Award-winning chef and a powerhouse in the cooking world.
So I was out the door early and home late, and after about 18 months, I remember my dad saying, I didn't understand this at all, but I've never seen anybody work as hard at what they're doing as you're working at this job.
Then we speak with Carl Schubert, who was just named 2017 Chef of the Year by the New Orleans Eater Awards.
So I enrolled at Delgado, and I remember one of the main chefs looked at me and said, so you have a bachelor's degree in business, and now you're getting, he's like, aren't you kind of doing this backwards?
We're presenting portraits of culinary artists on this week's Louisiana Eats. That's coming up next. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Trump's former chief strategist Steve Bannon uses the word treasonous to describe a meeting now on the FBI's radar that involved Donald Trump Jr., his brother-in-law Jared Kushner, the president's former campaign chair Paul Manafort, and a group of Russians. This according to excerpts from a new book in which journalist Michael Wolff quotes Bannon. As one of Trump's most trusted advisors, Bannon was often credited with helping Team Trump win the presidential race. But today, President Trump is taking it all back. NPR's Tamara Keith has more on Trump's stunning renunciation in a statement out today.
The White House is pushing back hard against this book, and in particular, against former top advisor Steve Bannon. In a rare statement from the President of the United States sent to the press corps, Trump says, quote, Steve Bannon has nothing to do with me or my presidency. When he was fired, he not only lost his job, he lost his mind. He describes Bannon as simply a staffer who came in late. And he also adds, quote, Steve doesn't represent my base. He's only in it for himself.
That's NPR's Tamara Keith reporting. The meeting among members of Trump's inner circle that Bannon referenced in the book is now part of a broader federal investigation into whether the Trump campaign helped Russia in any way to influence the outcome of the presidential election. Intelligence agencies have already concluded that Russia used wide-ranging tactics to undermine this country's political system. In Congress, Democrats are welcoming two new senators to their ranks. NPR's Kelsey Snell reports that Senators Doug Jones of Alabama and Tina Smith of Minnesota have taken the oath of office, reducing the GOP advantage in the chamber by one vote to a 51-49 margin.
Doug Jones and Tina Smith joined the Senate at a moment when Democratic leaders are looking to expand their influence and win concessions from Republicans on spending bills, immigration, and a potential infrastructure bill floated by President Trump. Vice President Mike Pence presided over the official swearing-in.
Congratulations, Senator.
Each represents a landmark of sorts. Jones is the first Democrat in 25 years to win a U.S. Senate seat in Alabama. Smith breaks ground by becoming the 22nd woman currently serving in the Senate, making this the largest group of women senators in history. Kelsey Snell, NPR News, Washington.
A winter storm is bearing down on the Deep South. He's South Carolina Public Radio's Victoria Hansen.
It's a rare sight. Palm fronds, dangling icicles. The problem right now is freezing rain, and it's only expected to get worse, with forecasters calling for 2 to 4 inches of snow and a winter storm warning until midnight. Area bridges are quickly shutting down, as are roads. A transportation official chose to be interviewed by phone, saying he, too, would rather stay off the roads.
This is NPR. Demonstrations in Iran are continuing today. Hundreds of people have been arrested over the past week. More than 20 have died in clashes with security forces in Iran. NPR's Peter Kenyon says state media are reporting pro-government rallies are also taking place.
Iranian media are focusing on the return of pro-government demonstrations, which posts on social media suggest were engineered by the government. Anti-government protests, meanwhile, are in their seventh day and still taking place in multiple cities and towns. Protesters are demanding economic improvements as well as drastic political and foreign policy changes that hardliners in Iran are loath to consider.
That's NPR's Peter Kenyon reporting. Now turning to Alaska, archaeologists have uncovered the bones of two infants dating back 11,500 years. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, their discovery sheds light on how the first people migrated to the Americas.
Scientists say the remains are among the oldest ever found in the Americas. DNA from one of the infants indicates they belonged to a group of people who left Asia perhaps 20 to 25,000 years ago. This founding group crossed a frozen land bridge that connected Siberia to Alaska, called Beringia. At some point, this founding group split. The so-called ancient Beringians stayed in the cold north. The infants belonged to that group. The other group moved down into North and South America and are believed to be the direct ancestors of Native Americans. Writing in the journal Nature, the researchers say the Beringians either died out or were absorbed by other Native American groups. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, committed to supporting ideas and institutions that advance the well-being of women and improve lives and livelihoods in developing countries. More information is available at hewlett.org.
Howdy, partners. This is Renella Rose Champagne, your host of Lost in Love. I hope you'll join me as we embark on our new time slot of Tuesdays at 1 p.m. right here on KRVS 88.7 FM in Lafayette and Lake Charles. Let's have some fun, y'all.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. If the life of a chef seems glamorous to you, you may be rethinking that by the close of today's show. Hard work and long hours, often for little compensation, is more the norm in the restaurant industry. This week, we're getting a reality check from some of the best and brightest Louisiana has to offer. New Orleans-born chef John Currents has achieved his success in the little town of Oxford, Mississippi, where he owns and operates City Grocery, Bouret, Big Bad Breakfast, and Snack Bar. We'll go back to the beginning with John and learn the story of his life's path. Carl Schubert is newer to the restaurant game than John, but he's been making waves with his North Shore restaurant, Baco Bar, and DTB here in the city. Despite his young age, Carl has had some major hurdles to overcome after a cancer diagnosis that would have had lesser folks rethinking their kitchen career. Get ready to be inspired by our amazing guests on this week's Louisiana Eats.
Hey, this is John Currents. I'm the chef and owner of City Grocery, Bouret, Big Bad Breakfast, Snack Bar, the Main Event, and the Lamar Lounge in Oxford, Mississippi. Or, I should say, I get credit for all the work that a mountain of other people that are really working hard actually do, and they call me chef.
Those who strike out on their own are often surprised to find that home inevitably seems to call them back. While Chef John Currents has found purpose and fame in Oxford, Mississippi, his passion for food is intrinsically linked to his childhood and early adult life in New Orleans. The James Beard Award-winning chef sat down with us to reflect on the formative moments of his career. As it turns out, one such moment involved a waffle maker, vodka, and a stolen bicycle.
It was a rainy Sunday, and my folks were watching a Saints game on a little black and white TV. And in my mind, like, everything was attached by extension cords across the room. And they had, and this part is very clear because I talked to my mom about this recently, they had this old Sunbeam waffle maker that my mom was making Rubens on. And so they were using the waffle machine, which maybe they had reversible plates or something, but was making Rubens on this waffle machine. And my dad was, you know, maybe making Bloody Bulls or something. It was raining, and I was dressed up like the Gordon's fisherman guy and like my yellow rain slicker and pants and boots. And I had a new Schwinn Stingray bicycle with a banana seat and a sissy bar and all that, and probably some purple and gold streamers coming out of the handlebars. And I'm just riding around our block on Britannia Street. I grew up right across the street from where St. James Cheese Company is. These, you know, these young kids, you know, came up out of the other neighborhood and stopped me. And this one kid had a hacksaw, and he says, "Get off your bike, or I'll cut your hand off."
Oh, God.
And so there I was, you know, just dejected and crying in the pouring rain as this fat kid rides off on my bicycle, you know, laughing and as slowly as he could go without the bicycle falling over. And so, of course, I go home and I'm crying and I'm soaking wet and water's coming off of me. And you know, and of course, it's like some sort of important point in the game. And my dad's like, yeah, just sit down, you know. And I'm sort of waiting for him to, you know, either make me feel better. I'm not a sissy. Like, he's going to get me a new bike or something. And he's like, just look, Archie's in a position here. We got to focus on the game. This is 3rd and 4. And at some point, he just kind of hands me his bloody bull. And he's like, have a sip of this. You know, just look, without even looking at me, just have a sip of this. You'll feel better.
Was it your paternal or your maternal grandfather who had a country store that I think also I just picked up from, you know, your meat curing, your making bacon and sausages from scratch? Somehow I feel like that experience of your grandfather's country store kind of figures in who you are today.
Well, it was my maternal grandfather, and they did have this wonderful little store. You know, strangely enough, it was called McDonald's, which I always thought was interesting because they were McDonald's, which is my middle name. And it was, you know, like a lot of those old country stores where, you know, rural, before they delivered newspapers, they delivered everybody's newspaper to the store. So everybody came into the store to have coffee and pick up their newspaper and get a honey bun. And you could buy slab bacon, or they'd slice bologna for you. There's a meat, you know, olive loaf, all that stuff. And frequently, you know, somebody would be toasting bread or making biscuits. And folks just like sat around a barrel fire and talked, or sat inside around a heater and a kerosene heater and just talked, you know, in the mornings. But yeah, all of that definitely informs, you know, my food. I never in my life dreamed, you know, that I was, you know, heading towards, you know, this future as a chef, or that I was going to make some sort of profound difference in people's lives, or, you know, or unearth something massive like, you know, a Sean Brock or Frank Stitt, you know, did in Southern food. There are enough things in my life that it made perfect sense, and it was almost inevitable that I would end up here. You know, and, you know, not the least of which is just growing up in New Orleans, where there was – it's not as if, you know, going to Antoine's every Christmas Eve sort of drove me to become a chef. But it certainly informed part of what I do, you know, every day, and certainly has given me a lot of fodder for stories. Sort of found cooking by mistake. My first job cooking was when I was put on a tugboat after my senior year in high school and was assigned the duties of the cook because I was a low man on the totem pole. And so I was cooking for 10 guys 3 times a day, you know, out in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. And so it was very much sort of a sink or swim situation. And I survived, but I also really enjoyed that galley cooking. I mean, it was strange to me because I'd never cooked really before with any sort of ambition at all. But this little bitty kitchen where you could – there's literally – you couldn't stand anywhere in the kitchen and not touch every other surface. It was tiny. And that led me to, you know, restaurant jobs when I was in college and post-college. And it was really moving back home to New Orleans after I had spent 3 years in the kitchen with Bill Neal at Crook's Corner in Chapel Hill, not young enough that I didn't understand the significance of being there, and then curating jobs because I wanted to learn more about it. So I had worked in the cut shop at the Food Lion grocery store because I wanted to learn how to cut meat. And I worked for a little Jewish smokehouse operation where I was butchering and brining and smoking bluefish and salmon by the hundreds of pounds. I got a job as a bread baker at an Italian restaurant because I wanted to learn how to bake bread. And all these things while I was in Chapel Hill were leading me down that path. But it wasn't until I came home to help Larkin Selman open Gautreaux's. And I saw the fire and the passion in Larkin and what he was capable of generating in the way of response in that little bitty dining room on Soniat Street, and realized that the thing that I loved about cooking was that it really combined all of the passions that I had all at once. I mean, it was artistic. It required an ability to approach technique and reproduce things consistently over and over and over again. It was intense getting ready for service and then even more intense during service. There was booze. There were drugs. I mean, it was everything in the world that I could want all at once. And it all went on, you know, sort of late at night. So there was a sinister thing about it. But you could stand at the door in the kitchen and look through the little diamond-shaped piece of glass out into the dining room and immediately gauge someone's response to something that you had made and they were putting in their mouths. And so those were all the things that really sort of led me to it. It was just – it was fun. It was intense. You were sharing a piece of your life with everything that went out, you know, to a diner. And these were all things that that I loved. And I think I understood early that, you know, that creating food was about storytelling. And so that really drew this moth to that flame.
When we come back from a short break, our conversation with Chef John Currents continues. But first, how many cookbooks has John Currents written, and what are they? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
How often have you turned to music for comfort or to make you even happier? We're not always sure why, but music has a powerful effect on our emotions. Let the music reach you each week on The Thistle and Shamrock.
Coming up Sunday evening at 6, here on KRVS.
Have you ever heard a story that changed the way you saw the world?
I had witnessed the terrifying joy of unbearable responsibility.
We fight for identity, sometimes we kill for identity, but why is that?
I can't let my life be this, because if I give up right now, that's what my life will be.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for inspiring stories on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Coming up tonight at 8 on KRVS.
Old gold, classic, solid. Time tested by you. Thursday at noon on KRVS. I'm Lee Kleinpeter, dropping the gauntlet and running the gamut from the 40s through the 70s. Rock, roll, soul, little this, little that. Just the way we like it. Thursdays at noon on KRVS.
Come with me, my high love, to the sea of love.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from the Napoleon House, located in the historic French Quarter, home of the Pimm's Cup cocktail and the toasted muffalata. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 500 Charter Street. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How many cookbooks has John Currents written, and what are they? Chef John Currents has been honored with a James Beard Award nomination 6 times. 4 of those nominations were for Best Chef for his stellar work at Oxford, Mississippi's City Grocery Restaurant. He won that award in 2009 after having been nominated for it in 2005, 6, 7, and 8. Since winning the Best Chef Award, he's also received nominations for both of his cookbooks, Pickles, Pigs, and Whiskey, a title that says a mouthful about John, was nominated in the American Cooking category in 2014. And his most recent book, Big Bad Breakfast, received a nomination this year. Way to go, John. Keep up the good work. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. And now our conversation with John Currents continues. Knowing that John's parents had put him through a full education at the prestigious Newman School in New Orleans, I asked John about their initial reaction when he chose a career in the kitchen.
My father was very troubled at first. I don't think he understood at all, you know, why it was that I was going down this road. I think he had hoped probably when I came home from Chapel Hill that I took this job with Larkin just as a as a bridge to whatever I was going to do and, you know, maybe just enroll in Tulane and finish up my classes and, you know, and go on to do something noble. And I know that in the first couple of years that I was back home that we had conversations that kind of touched on it a little bit. But the most vivid memory that I have was him sitting down with me one day and saying, you know, I didn't understand this at all. Because when I moved home, I moved back in with my parents and I lived with them. So I was out the door early and home late. And after about 18 months, I remember my dad saying, I didn't understand this at all, but I've never seen anybody work as hard at what they're doing as you're working at this job. And he goes, so now while I worry about, you know, you and, you know, whether you're being compensated fairly for what you're doing, I have to tell you, I'm impressed. And if this is what you want to do, you know, you need to continue this path because clearly, you know, it's what you want. You know, he's also the same guy who, you know, I remember sitting in a cab outside of a restaurant called the Gay Hussar in London when I was about 12 years old. And before we got out of the cab to go inside, I remember my father telling me very specifically, he said, I want you to when you go inside here to understand that the gentlemen in tuxedos here that are waiting tables, there's some of them that have waited tables here for 30 or 40 years. This is their job. And we don't recognize service as a noble profession in the United States. But these are people who they are very proud of what they do. They're respected for doing that job within the community. And oddly, you know, in spite of the fact that a very small percentage of guys in my industry, you know, reach the point of celebrity that, you know, I'm at the very bottom end of that, but, you know, it's still not really recognized as a noble profession. And, I mean, to the point where I just had a conversation at lunch today why, you know, I've never been invited to Newman for career day or to share my experiences in my career as an author or, you know, as a chef, you know, or the people that I'm connected to or what that connectivity means, you know, back to Newman. And, you know,
I've had this conversation with Neil Bodenheimer, with Adam Biederman, with Larkin. None of us. I mean, we've got guys that are, you know, that are very accomplished in our field, but, you know, it's still, they don't need us infecting their young doctors and lawyers. And that's kind of a sad thing to me.
John, why do you think you've been so successful at this?
You know, I take a very honest approach. I knew when I opened that I didn't possess the ability to create, you know, a statement about some particular kind of food because I didn't have enough experience or education or passion for one particular area of food. I was just passionate about food in general. I knew that, you know, even like going into Oxford, that if I tried to overreach my abilities as a chef, that I would fail in a heartbeat. And that I was in a town that was hungry for something, but I knew that they were going to want quantity. They were going to want quality. And as a result, we created menus that combined flavors and textures that people would like, things that I had cooked before, but they were from all over the world and just sort of depending on what I was into in the day. And so that honesty, I think, people appreciated. And it wasn't, you know, until about 8 or 10 years in that, you know, I finally got so exhausted with knowing that I couldn't answer the question, which, you know, Frank Stitt was the first one to ask me about 2 years into my cooking was, you know, he asked me, he said, explain your philosophy on food, you know, to me. And I went, philosophy? And I thought I left that behind in Virginia at the all-boys school. I don't know what you're talking about. And I just kind of ran away from this conversation. But it troubled me that, you know, I was also having people ask me just like, explain your restaurant. And I didn't have an elevator pitch for it. I couldn't give, you know, a subtitle for City Grocery and that I needed to figure out what it was that I was doing. And that really, you know, it took me about 8 years to really figure out, you know, sort of what was going on and what it was that drove me to cook.
How did it feel to win that James Beard Award, Best Chef of the South in 2009?
I'm not going to lie to you. My wife got me hammered before that. And I mean, there was no reason for me to believe that I was going to win. I mean, I still to this day, you know, I tell folks every year, it's like 2009 was the worst recession year for awards that must have ever happened if I won that thing. Because when I look at the guys that I was nominated against, like the slate of talent was so fantastic. I think it was my fifth year to be nominated. And, you know, and I'd gotten to where I had just paralyzing butterflies in my stomach. And I didn't want to ever appear to be disappointed because I really was so flattered, you know, to just be included in that group of, you know, of incredibly talented chefs every year. That we went out to Danielle Belloud's place right before we went, and I had two double bourbons just so that, you know, I could just like not care when they didn't call my name, and we could sort of coast through this 11-hour long award ceremony. And so my wife and I remember we got in the auditorium and we were just giggling and giggling and giggling. And I wasn't even following the program. I didn't know that our category had even come up because it was very early in the program that year, and we were giggling about something. And all of a sudden she goes, "Oh my God, that's you up on the screen." But, I mean, honestly, it was the most flattering moment professionally that, you know, that I can ever imagine. But, you know, I also knew and I think I said as much when I accepted it that, you know, it's a shame that they give that award to a chef because that chef doesn't exist without every person, you know, that has contributed to putting that food together and putting it on a table, serving it, managing it, washing the dishes. I mean, and, you know, even the rotten SOBs that you've had to fire participated in helping propel you to that point. And so it was a wonderful night, and it was a wonderful and exhausting night. I think I was in bed within an hour after it was over because I was just such an emotional wreck.
Well, Congratulations. That's quite a successful tale, my dear.
I know. It's kind of exhausting just listening to that, isn't it?
Hey, man, I'm in awe. So I'm in awe, and I'm thrilled to have had this chance to have such a wonderful, wonderful chat with you. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, love.
John Currents, author and James Beard Award-winning chef.
My name is Carl Schubert. I am the chef and co-owner of DTB, a newer restaurant on Oak Street in Uptown New Orleans, and also of Baco Bar, which is in Covington, Louisiana.
Chef Carl Schubert is known for his ability to create inventive and approachable menus that marry regional and international flavors. The New Orleans native began his culinary career in local restaurants before accepting the position of sous chef at Commander's Palace in 2011. 2 years later, at the age of 31, Carl was promoted to executive chef at Cafe Adelaide. Carl is a culinary dynamo. But in 2014, he was diagnosed with advanced esophageal and gastric cancer, underwent extensive surgery, and a long round of chemo. After recovering from that and getting clean scans, he opened a new restaurant, Baco Bar, on the North Shore, quickly followed by a second, DTB, in Uptown New Orleans. While preparing for the latter to open, he learned the cancer had returned. Carl has received many accolades, the most recent being the 2017 Eater Awards, naming him New Orleans Chef of the Year. He's also been named Chef Ambassador of Ochsner's Eat Fit program. We invited Carl to tell us the story of his electrifying career and how he's become a powerful voice for quality of life in the culinary industry. As native New Orleanians, we're obsessed with food. We're born that way.
Absolutely.
Carl, when did you decide that food was going to be your life?
To say that food was part of life is, you know, a literal explanation. I mean, it is life. It's every day. I grew up half Italian, and then the other side is Cajun, French, and German. So both grandmothers on either side could cook. You know, my grandfather on my father's side was one of the better cooks I had ever met, and literally grew up kind of tugging at their apron strings and always seeing that the center of every household was the kitchen. I mean, everything revolved around the kitchen. No matter how big or small that kitchen was, everybody was in there for some reason. One of my first food memories, actually, and this still sticks with me to this day, and this gives you a little insight into how we grew up here, right? Two things that I remember eating for the first time. One was a raw oyster on the half shell, and I got the instructions, and I don't know if it was like them laughing at me or them truly interested in watching me do this, but it was my dad and his best friend. And of course, you know, they were probably drinking a cold Dixie or 20. I don't know how many it was at that point. And I remember taking that oyster down, and it was ice cold, and I'm like, oh, this is so good. And then I started to kind of chew it and chew it and chew it. And that oyster didn't quite make it all the way down. But it became this kind of like challenge to me to say like, well, everybody else loves these things. So eventually, into this day, it's absolutely one of my most favorite things, not only to eat, but to see just an ice chest full of unshucked oysters, uh-huh. To grab an oyster knife and to crack them open. And then the other really vivid food memory I have is a very greasy paper bag with blood boudin noir inside of it as well. And that one didn't quite make it all the way down either. But I did try it. And again, to this day, boudin is, of course, one of my all-time favorites. You know, in New Orleans, people think, what do they say? We, you know, eat too much, drink too much, laugh too loud. It's like, well, that is the comfort for us. You know, you say comfort food, but that's literally when things are good or they're bad, we eat and we drink. And then, you know, that usually leads to the laughter, which who would want to live any other way, right? We also would go out to eat for special occasions. The special occasion place for us was Commander's Palace. And so that's where I really got the first glimpse of the chef as this, like, larger than life, bigger than my grandmother's kitchen. Food was more than just the comfort, more than just that. It was also an art form and a celebration and this just theater. It was as simple as a Cobb salad, you know? But it was, like, perfectly lined up, and everything was diced perfectly. And I'm thinking to myself, like, wow, this looks very pretty. And then I started to eat it, and I was like, okay, this makes a lot of sense that they cut everything that way for a reason. It was to get kind of, once you mix it on your own, you got that perfect bite in every bite. You know, the mixture of the bacon and the blue cheese and the avocado and the shrimp or whatever it was. And then you started to think, like, okay, all this is for a reason. This isn't just for the theater. It's the lines of the movie. Now they make sense to the surroundings. And that's when things really became more about the overall experience. I really want to see what's behind those doors. So, you know, my dad likes to tell a story. He said, one day I came home early from work, and you were about 16. You know, the lights were kind of turned down, and the TV was kind of turned up, and he's like, you know, expecting to maybe walk in on me doing something I wasn't supposed to be doing.
Yeah,
who knows?
You're up to no good.
And he says, I walked in, and you had a Martha Stewart Living magazine with the recipe section opened up on your lap, and you were watching the Food Network, like, blaring, you know, and you were intently watching this stuff. He's like, at that point, I would have rather you walk in on you doing something taboo. He's like, because then I was really kind of worried about you. Like, what's going on with this kid? You know, from then on, it was, what do you want for Christmas? Well, it wasn't CDs and things like that anymore. It was cookbooks, and it was, you know, textbooks on cooking and knives and
knives.
Kitchen gadgets. Yeah. And but I knew that I wanted to learn kind of the business part of it before the food part of it, so to speak. I was like, I can kind of learn the food part a little bit on my own. I sat down with Steve Woodruff, who's the director of operations for Commander's Palace. He was a good friend of my uncle. And his advice was, you know, I would jump in with both feet. Maybe not go to culinary school, you know, continue to just, like, cook at different restaurants, get mentorship, apprenticeships, whatever you want to call them, and really tackle the business side of things and learn all aspects, the wine, the service, the food. And I took his advice, and that's what I did. And I just cooked at a few restaurants kind of in Baton Rouge area to learn how to work the line, so to speak, to just get that kitchen IQ, really.
So in college, you started working in restaurants?
I did. You know, mom and pop spots. So I got my degree from LSU, bachelor's degree in business management, entrepreneurship. And then I started working in West End for Tommy Wolfe at Wolfe's for a little bit, doing front of the house, actually. I didn't even cook there because, you know, upon Steve's advice, I wanted to round myself out and do that. And then I helped open a restaurant called Fire on Annunciation, which was kind of a new spot, and it was kind of hip, and they were doing something different. It was right there by the Soleil. And I was working front of the house again. I really wanted to learn wines. And they had a cool wine program. It was all New World stuff. And the owner was very hands-on. Brenda Darr is her name. She's still a great friend and mentor of mine. But I knew they needed some help in the kitchen. So I said, well, you know what? Maybe I'll go get my associate's degree at Delgado, work a little in the kitchen, work a little in the front of the house, make ends meet, but still get that cooking degree that, you know, it can't hurt, right? So I enrolled at Delgado. And I remember one of the main chefs looked at me and said, so you have a bachelor's degree in business, and now you're getting, he's like, aren't you kind of doing this backwards? I said, I'm just here to learn, chef. And that day I left to go on vacation right after the first day of school, and then Katrina hit. Delgado called about 3 months later and said, hey, you know, would you rather us refund your money, or do you want to enroll when we get back up and going? I said, I'll go ahead and just take that check back if you don't mind.
One day of cooking school.
Yeah, whenever I tell people that, they always think it's going to end up in a much different story.
That's great.
So I kind of took that as a sign and said, you know what, let's just keep going. Let's get my butt back in the kitchen. Let's learn as much as I can. And that's what I did at Fire, and worked my way up to sous chef. And then we actually moved about a year and a half after Katrina to Grayton Beach, Florida, the 30A area, panhandle of Florida.
Were you married by then?
I was not. I was in my mid-20s. I got an offer to be the executive chef of a restaurant on the beach. And I was single. And I said, well, yeah.
Yeah, way to go.
Let's do it.
Hell yeah.
So, you know, of course, did a lot of learning, a lot of growing there. I was an immature, hotshot guy who thought he knew it all. And I was humbled very quickly by a lot of great mentors that are still in my life, and learned a lot of things. That's where I did meet and get married to and begin a family with my beautiful and wonderful wife, Alexandra, Alex Schubert. And we got married and we had our first child. His name's Carl. Well, it's Carl Joseph. He's a second, so we call him Carr because there's three Carls in our family. It gets confusing. And, you know, we really looked at our life and said, you know what, we love our life. We love where we are. Of course, we're at the beach. It's great. It's this whole thing. But it's not New Orleans. It's not, you know, I was at that point, I had gotten some acclaim, some accolades, definitely big, kind of big in the restaurant community, but I was I guess what you'd call a big fish in a small pond, so to speak. And, you know, we were all about challenges and pushing ourselves. And my dream was to open and own or become a chef in New Orleans. I mean, this is a city I grew up in. This is a city that birthed, so to speak, the chefs I emulated. So made the decision that we wanted to move back. So I started the feelers out there and contacting people I knew and chefs and people I'd worked with and all that kind of stuff. And a friend, I think, passed along my resume to Lally Brennan. And I'd got a call just randomly from Tori McPhail. And he said, you know, we got your resume, got a hold of it, like what I see, you know, would you like to come down, stage, blah, blah, blah. And I was kind of like, well, let me step outside for a second here. And then it became real. I staged at a few places and interviewed at a few places. I got some great offers to be executive chef, some, you know, chef de cuisine, some sous chef here or there. And, you know, Commander just kept coming back to front of mind. You know, if this is truly about growing and about learning and about maturing and about getting my name out there and really just being better at what I do, then is there really a much better restaurant in the city?
So you leave your executive chef spot. What is the position that you then move into at Commander's?
So I was a sous chef there. Technically, I guess PM sous chef. There's a big brigade over there. And when you come in from outside in that kitchen, it's very challenging because you're basically superseding a bunch of people who busted their butts working from the ground up in blood, sweat, and tears to get, you know, that to that kind of sous chef position. And, you know, so you kind of have a bullseye on your back from the get-go with different people, and rightly so. It's a competitive kitchen. It's a real deal place. Yeah, so I was a sous chef there, of course, with the intention of, you know,
moving on.
Keep going, you know, right? So,
but then something magical happened when it came time to move on.
So we got news that we were going to have another baby. And it was going to be a girl this time. And it was just unbelievably exciting and scary and emotional and all that stuff at the same time. And then not too long after I got that news, T and Tori pulled me aside and offered me the position of executive chef at Cafe Adelaide, which is, of course, their sister restaurant in the Lowe's Hotel, and a beautiful space and just charming spot and a fun menu and just a huge opportunity because I'd only been there with the company for about 2 years.
What an incredible thing. It just shows you how the cream rises to the top.
Well, I appreciate that, or they're really desperate. I'm not sure.
No, I don't think that was it.
No, it was a very quick marriage that really just worked out, you know, and you can tell when things are working out and that you're clicking on the right cylinders.
When we come back from a short break, our conversation continues with Carl Schubert, chef and co-owner of DTB and Baco Bar. Stay tuned.
We all make mistakes in life. Si tu avais manqué la dernière Franco mix, c'est OK. Tu peux m'écouter this Thursday at 9 p.m. seulement sur KRVS 88.7 avec Drake Benoit LeBlanc. Et c'est formidable.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life. And is this news?
I didn't always want to go to the senior center because I have arthritis and my arthritis began to hurt. And I didn't want to go there and play bridge. It was much more fun to go shoplifting.
Bringing you all the parts of the world that don't fit into the daily news programs. Go out of your way for it. This American Life from Public Radio International.
7 p.m. Wednesdays on KRVS.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blended beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. If you're just joining us, we've been talking with Carl Schubert, chef and co-owner of DTB New Orleans and Baco Bar in Covington. When we left off, the year was 2013, and at the young age of 31, Carl was tapped for the position of executive chef at Cafe Adelaide. Just 2 years later, his life was turned upside down. While undergoing a procedure to diagnose what was thought to be an ulcer, his doctor discovered a tumor in the junction of his stomach and esophagus. It turned out to be cancerous.
So I was diagnosed in 2014 with advanced esophageal and gastric cancer. I was diagnosed on April 1st, April Fool's Day. My brother said to me, he's like, you know, and this is after it was okay, you know, we were able to talk about it a little bit more candidly, but he said, I was either the most sad I've ever been in my life, or I thought you were the biggest jerk and horrible April Fool's joke you could ever play on somebody. But unfortunately, it was true.
What an ironically, incredibly terrible thing for a chef.
Yes, yes. So we actually, it's funny because we, a bunch of friends and some colleagues and just amazing people, it's hard to even talk about it, but they threw a benefit and we thought it would, I guess they came up with the term kicking cancer in the gut.
Cancer in anybody's life, it affects you in different ways. But for a chef who works 60 to 70 hours a week, how did it affect your life?
Well, it's in every aspect, really, you know. So the first way it affects you is mentally, and that's the biggest way it affects you. And that's anybody with cancer that's dealt with cancer, and they'll tell you, I mean, I'd say the easy part is the physical part of it. You know, the hard part is the mental, because the mental then affects every other thing you're dealing with. So mine being basically what they did for me was an esophagectomy and a partial gastrectomy. And these are medical terms, but essentially they removed about a quarter to a half of my stomach. So I got this like little baby stomach. So again, for a chef who's used to being able to dine and eat, and of course, you know, the way I did everything had to change. So the way I looked at food, the way I looked at calories, the way I looked at diet, the way I looked at nutrition, energy levels, you know, medication, all that had to change. You know, I had a 17-hour surgery that took about 6 months to recover from. So, you know, you have to completely just alter, you know, kind of everything you do. And there was a time where I was doing radiation as well. So even like drinking water hurt, you know. But I still wanted to work, of course. And, you know, I still had to taste and you had to develop dishes and menus and things like that.
What did you observe in yourself, the way you learned to compensate for perhaps not being able to taste in the same way?
Well, you have to mentor even more strongly. You have to trust your people that you've hired and trained and worked with even more. You have to write things down and look at food and creation of dishes in a more, I don't know, analytical approach than just kind of off the cuff and trial by error, so to speak. And, you know, I mean, I still to this day, I have to get people to help me taste a lot because of all the chemotherapy I've done. Some of the side effects of that chemotherapy has been, you know, definitely a difference in tastes and things like that without getting too graphic. So you just have to rely on the people and you take on a different role.
So you were at Adelaide and you get this diagnosis and you went through that difficult initial period of time. What in God's name made you think that it was a good time to open up a new restaurant?
Well, two, actually. Two
How
restaurants.
Close were those two restaurants?
They were closer than I'd probably do over again in terms of ability, but I don't definitely regret anything I've done. It was definitely a one life to live, you know, kind of this is the dream, this is the ultimate goal. What if I don't make it, what can I leave to my children kind of thing, you know? I loved my time at Cafe Adelaide. I loved my time with the Brands family. But, you know, the kind of one thing about the older families in the city, you know, they've got enough of their own things going on. So while they did take immense, immense care of me in so many ways other than just financial, but I wanted to, you know, I wanted to make sure there was always my dream to have my own restaurant, open my own. And a great friend and colleague of mine, his name's Jean-Pierre Guidry, he approached me with a possible investor who's now become one of my great friends and partners, Jacob Nockhan. And then we three of us opened Baco Bar together on the North Shore. And that was kind of a, hey, look, let's step out of our box comfort zone. Let's do something fun. Let's do something just kind of hip and kind of, you know, for the North Shore that we see to fit. So February 2016, we opened. But that whole time, we were conceiving and conceptualizing DTB as well. And I was in remission at the time. So I had had my surgery and follow-up chemo and all that. So that was about a nine-month ordeal. Then I was back at Adelaide for another few months. And then that's when the opportunity kind of came my way. To be honest with you, it kind of presented itself to me, and I couldn't really pass it up. And we knew we wanted to make a splash and make a difference. And I always, Oak Street was always one of my favorite streets. And they redid this beautiful building, the old Woolworth building. And we had our eye on a few spots around town. And that was one of those typical New Orleans situations where I knew the landlord through this person. And we worked out a deal because of this and that happened. And this, and everything just kind of fell into place the way that we hoped it would. And it was kind of one of those, this is too good to pass up. But unfortunately, after about a year and a half of being in remission, it came back. Cancer came back. So we got that news about a year and a half ago now. And I was right in the middle of, we were right in the middle of opening the second restaurant when we got word of that.
What was that like, Carl? It's like, oh my goodness, we fought this battle.
Yeah.
And now here we are, and we've got two restaurants, and we've got two kids, and holy moly.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Well, we did what any logical person would do. We we took out a big loan, and we opened a Pilates studio for my wife and renovated our house, because that made a lot of sense. No, that to be honest with you, we did what things we knew we wanted to do, not knowing how much longer I had left. I have left still. We kind of said, let's build ourselves for the future, and let's, I hate this term, but, you know, live like we're dying, so to speak, and not hold back anything. We're going to build this restaurant. It's going to be one of the best in the city, hopefully in the country. And not because of awards or accolades or anything like that, but because we truly want, I want the people of New Orleans to love coming to this restaurant. I want them to have an incredible time every time they come. I want them to, you know, just have a envie, so to speak, for entering our front doors. So I was able to focus then on kind of saying, look, you know, my partner took over kind of the reins at Baco Bar up on the North Shore, and I focused more on opening DTB. And that allowed me to focus more on all the medical stuff that I had to start doing, because obviously I've been going through chemotherapy and this thing and that thing, and some things work and some things don't, and I'm flying back and forth to MD Anderson, Houston, things like that. So, you know, every week's different, every day is different. You wake up kind of feeling, you know, good or bad or whatever it is. But the one thing you can control is mentally how you feel and mentally how you approach things. And I've said that all along, and people are always like, you always seem like nothing's wrong. You always seem like, you know, you look okay and this and that. And I said, well, that's what, yeah, I mean, you know, it's like when you ask somebody how's their day going and they say, you know, it's not really what I want to hear. You know, at least lie right to me. At least say, it's going great. You know, could be a lot worse, whatever it is. So I think that's the way I approach it when people ask me, you know, how are you doing? How are things going? And, you know, the other thing I tell people, you know, and this applies to people facing terminal illness or just business or just raising children or just walking down the street, but, you know, and say, how can you be so positive? Like, what is the alternative?
Right.
You know, I don't know any other way to live. I don't know any other way to run a restaurant, to be a husband, to be a father, to be, you know, of course, are we like that all the time? No, but to be positive more often than not is, for me, just the way to do things.
one of the things that you have done that I greatly admire, you would think that anybody with everything we've just heard on your plate that you've got might not have the time to volunteer and give it away. And yet, every time I turn around, if it comes to health, wellness, you know, fighting illness with your diet, you're right there on the forefront.
Well, so, you know, I mean, it's just about, again, just continuing to live your life the way you would live it no matter what, you know. So I said, you know, when I got re-diagnosed and I knew I'd be on these intense drugs and traveling and not sure how I would feel every day, I said, one thing I know I can do is I can do the PR stuff. I can do the philanthropies. I can do the wonderful, you know, cooking demos for the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. You know, whatever it is, those are things that I can do. So if my days of throwing on the chef coat and working behind the line for 14 hours and hooting and hollering are over, well, then there's other things that I can do to not only promote our restaurant, but the culinary scene of New Orleans and the greater good of our city and the greater good of chefs in general. And that's what I'm going to continue to do, you know. And recently we've gotten some, you know, a little bit worse news that you know, it's looking like our options are becoming more limited. But doesn't mean we're going to stop fighting. It doesn't mean we're going to stop, you know, continuing to push and continuing to do as much as we can. And my wife looked at me the other day and she said, well, what are you going to do with the restaurants? And I was just like, well, I don't really know what else I can do if I'm not writing down dishes or creating, you know, spreadsheets for costing or mentoring cooks. I'm like, not really sure what else there is for me out there. It's not like this life changer. I'm going to go become a actor or something, you know, at this point. So, you know, the answer is just continuing to do what we love and whatever form that comes to us.
Carl Schubert, chef and co-owner of DTB New Orleans and Baco Bar in Covington. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. If you love Louisiana Eats, let others know and help like-minded Louisiana food lovers find our show by leaving a review on iTunes. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from the Palace Cafe, home of crab meat cheesecake and white chocolate bread pudding in the historic Whirline Music Building on Canal Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris, and to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook too. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.
From New Orleans, it's American Roots and Friends.
Hey, everybody! This is Coco Taylor.
Hi, folks. This is Ralph Stanley.
This is Solomon Burke.
Merle Haggard.
Tom Waits.
Hi, this is Bonnie Raitt.
These are Rosas of Los Lobos.
Mavis.